You are listening to KVRX Austin 91.7 FM. It's Monday at 8:30, which means you're tuned into They Blinded Me with Science, bringing you the best in science news and interviews from all over the place and all over the world of the fields of science. And we've got an interviewee for you tonight in a subject we don't really cover that often, astronomy. So I'm going to let our regular DJs go around, and then one of us will introduce our guest. I am DJ Ganglion.
I'm DJ Arnott.
I'm DJ Chrysalis.
So, I think it was DJ Chrysalis who booked this guest. So, do you wanna introduce him for us to the world of radio?
Yes, I can do that. And actually, we can ask him more in depth what he does. So, Joel Green is our guest today, and he works on the beginnings of things in astronomy. So he works on formation of stars and formation of planets. And you are, I guess, your title is a research associate with the University of Texas at Austin.
That's right. So I study the beginnings of solar systems, and I try to connect up what we see around brand new stars that are just being born all across the galaxy, but as close to us as possible, so that they're easy to see. And I try to connect up what we see in our own solar system, the fossil record of asteroids and comets and dust that we see in our own solar system, to what we see around other stars.
So when you talk about this fossil record, what kinds of things are you looking for to kind of get at the looking in the past for?
Well, so the easiest way to describe it is to explain a little bit about how stars are born. Stars are born in clouds of gas with little dust particles hanging suspended in them. And these are the same kinds of dust particles that you might see on Earth. And ice particles and things that are sort of smaller things, but essentially could eventually form into things like comets and planets. And these particles initially are separated. And the force of two forces, the force of gravity, the fact that all things are attracted to everything else, and the closer they get, the more attracted they are. And the more massive they are, the more attracted they are. And then what's called conservation of momentum, which is the effect of if you ever look at a dancer spinning and they pull their arms in, they spin faster. So particles that are initially very spread out in this big soup, when they fall in under the force of gravity, they spin up faster and faster and form into a kind of disc-shaped system. So imagine what the planet Saturn looks like with its rings. Now imagine that whole setup blown up to huge proportions. You take, instead of Saturn, you have something the size of the sun in the middle that has formed out of the collapsed gas. And little bits of particles, bits of gas and particles that have not stuck to that star or been ejected, end up stuck spinning around in this disk, this very flat pancake-shaped disk. After a very short period of time, actually, only a few tens of thousands of years, you have this disk. And that is where this disk is denser than what Saturn has right now. So Saturn's particles are these icy crystals and things like that. They don't collide with each other much anymore. But if you look at Saturn's rings, you'll notice little gaps in the rings. And those gaps are actually where little, tiny little moons have cleared out of space. They're called shepherd moons. Imagine that writ large with gas. And this is how planets come to be. They sweep out sections of this disk over the first... This all happens within the first few million years of the lifetime of a star. So our whole planetary system, Earth, Jupiter, Saturn, all of them, formed within the first few to maybe tens of millions of years. So the gas giants seem to form quicker. That's one of the things we've learned, actually. But anyway, eventually you end up with this planetary system. So this is not just our past, but it's happening all the time around the galaxy right now. And so there are these clusters of stars that form in groups of hundreds or thousands. And that's what I study. But the way that we study them, and this is to get back to the point about what the fossil record might contain, is we not only do we see them as just points of light, which you would ask, how could you learn anything about that from a point of light? Well, you may or may not, but the best way to do it is to do what's called spectroscopy, which is where you split the light into different frequencies that tell you things about what emitted that light in the first place. So basically it's chemical fingerprints around these from these stars, and we can tell from those chemical fingerprints what chemicals are there, what chemistry, what rocks, what kinds of gas, and how fast it's moving. And you put all that together, and even if you can't see anything, and even if it just looks like a dot, with a nice, sophisticated model, you can turn that into a star and planetary system. And this is how we investigate how planetary systems are essentially born.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the tools that you're using to do this the spectroscopy, and like what kind of telescopes you use, if you're using telescopes?
So they are telescopes, actually. Okay. But some of them are on the ground and some of them are in space. So one of the things about planetary systems forming is they're surrounded by dust. And if you flick dust in the air, you'll notice that you can see it. And it's actually scattering light away from you. And so it's obscuring your vision, right? So that's because you're looking at it in the wavelengths that our eyes can see. That's the optical, or the visible spectrum. If you go to longer wavelengths or lower frequency energy, the photons can penetrate that dusty veil and tell you about what's going on underneath, which is where the star and planets are forming. So we need to move to lower frequencies. That's the infrared and eventually the microwave and radio. So we need telescopes that are very sensitive to infrared light, and that is something that there are parts of the infrared spectrum that we can see very well, and there are parts that our atmosphere, thankfully for us, obscures from us, particularly things involving water, because there's a lot of water in the atmosphere. But if we actually want to see anything, we have to get to a place where there isn't much water in the way, or as little as possible. So that means you have to get to dry places like West Texas, McDonald Observatory, or you have to get to even drier places, very tops of very high mountains like the summit of Mauna Kea, where I've done a lot of my research.
And where is that?
That is on the Big Island of Hawaii, which is an amazing island, which has, I think they say, 31 of the 33 climate zones on the Earth are on that island. So we were there in December, and it was a blizzard. And then we went down to the beach the next day, and it was 85 degrees. So it's quite an interesting place to be anyway. But if that's not good enough for you, and in some cases it isn't, you know, that's where you put your biggest telescopes, are in the driest places. But if you want to get through that atmosphere, that pesky atmosphere, you have to go even higher. So there's a new telescope that hasn't yet been taking much data called SOFIA, which is actually the Stratospheric Observatory. It's in a 747. But sometimes even that's not good enough. So I've been using most recently the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is a NASA observatory, which is in space. It's about 60 million miles away at this point, rounding around the backside of the sun, or eventually it's going to. It's still operating, but because it's an infrared telescope, infrared is heat. And if your telescope is too warm, it will detect itself. And that's a big problem. So you have to keep your telescope very, very cool, which means you stick it inside of a giant thermos bottle, basically. And that's what this is. It's just a huge thermos bottle filled with liquid helium.
So going back just a couple steps, you mentioned where you do your research, and kind of wanted to go off on a tangent to that and talk about exactly what you research. You talked about the formation of stars, but I know we looked at a little bit of background on your work before you came in, and in the past year, you've been working on a star, I believe it's called a protostar called HBC 722, and this is, from what I understand, pretty exciting in the astronomical community, because you don't get very many opportunities to see stars forming in this way. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what's special about that, and also what's special about and really interesting about seeing stars forming, considering that what kind of gets translated into the mass media about astronomy is usually about stars dying or stars exploding and the ends
black
of things.
Holes.
Black holes. So what's so great about seeing things form when you could be seeing things?
Well, one thing I've always thought is kind of funny about the mass media, actually, is that they love supernovae, they love black holes, and they don't know anything about how stars form. If you watch Star Trek or something like that, they think aliens are on every single planet and, you know, every place is habitable. And really, if they were to actually show a real image of, or an imagined but a real image, if you were to fly a spaceship near one of these planetary systems, it would look amazing. You would see this cascading waterfall of gas and dust pouring onto this disk as it spins around. It would be quite a sight. What's interesting about this star, HBC 722, which has one of the typically exciting names assigned by catalog number, And they have other names that are even less or even longer, actually. This particular star is an example, the most recent example. It became an example only 1 year ago of a star that has had the reset button pushed. So I sort of quickly explained how planets formed by this collapse under gravity. But imagine if you haven't finished collapsing and you start that planet. So you still have the star in the middle and you start that planetary system with a disk and you form some kind of planet. And it's coalescing into a larger object. But behind it, material is still trying to fall into the disk. And it's landing behind that star. And it actually gets stuck in a resonance, we think. And it builds up and up over a relatively long period of time, a few thousand years. And then it reaches a critical point where it flushes the entire system. It overwhelms the planet and flushes the entire planetary system into the star. This creates a very dramatic explosion. The star gets 100 times brighter. And this is a unique opportunity to study how things actually translate from the disk to the star. So one of the things I did was when we saw one of these go off, and these only happen about once a decade, and the last one I think was in the 80s, or maybe the 70s actually, I decided to point sort of all of the modern instruments I could get my hands on at this star. And so in the same week, we used the Herschel Space Observatory. We used telescopes at McDonald, including the Hobby Eberle Telescope. We used the NearSpec, a bunch of different instruments in Hawaii as well. It was quite a collaboration, and some X-ray telescopes in space. And it was a lot of fun, and in the end, we discovered that we hadn't been quick enough and because we'd waited a month since peak. So something very exciting happens at the very edge of these, at the very beginning of these processes. And we are now seeing the echoes of it. And so what my work now and what that press release was about is that I'm using McDonald Observatory to study the star and see if there's any leftover echoes from this process.
So just because you don't study dying stars doesn't mean that you don't get to see lots of cool explosions in space.
It turns out it happens at all times.
All right.
Space is always exploding.
In the field of astronomy, the big general field, how common is it for people to study protostars and the formation of new planets and new stars?
It's a big subfield, and it's gained in popularity because now, of course, in the last 15 years, we finally discovered other planets around old stars like the Sun. And so the questions, now we have things to compare to, so we can say what kinds of stars are the ones that form planets. So this is sort of it's trying to answer the question of what are the materials available for planet formation in general. And, you know, what we're learning about other planets that are now forming around, or that have already formed around other stars, we kind of are getting a feel for how many of those there are. So now we're going to get an idea of what kind of diversity of planetary systems there are out there if you put these two fields together. And so it's kind of grown in tandem with the exoplanet field, which I think gets a little bit more dramatic press release. And in fact, has had its, I would say, its greatest triumph now with Kepler-22b, this new star, this new planet that is Earth-sized, which is very exciting. It's the first detection of an Earth-sized planet. And this was basically history was made. But we want to know, how did that planet get there? What kinds of stars are host stars for planets? And what sorts of minerals do they have around them? Because we're not just talking about abstract things. We can actually see in spectra, we can see crystal structure, we can see gas, we can see water, we can see carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, all these different building blocks of what form planets here. And then we can trace that with layers that we see in asteroids and comets. And that's sort of going to tell us a little bit about our own solar system's history. And I guess the fundamental question we're trying to answer is there only one route from cloud collapse to star and planetary system? Or does it follow several paths? And what kind of variety does that lead?
Well, we're going to take a very, very short break to play a couple of promos, but I'd like to remind everyone out there that our number is 512-495-KVRX. Again, that's 512-495-5879. We're talking with Dr. Joel Green, research associate here at UT Austin. So if you want to drill him on astronomy knowledge, quiz him on the names of stars, we'll be here for another 10 to 12 minutes. Thanks.
You're listening to 91.7 KVRX Austin, Texas.
Powered by dramatic prairie dogs.
Musiki.
Music.
Politismos. culture.
See heaven here.
Entertainment.
Each week, Austin Hellenic Radio brings you the very best in Greek music and culture. Austin Hellenic Radio, a program for Hellenes and Philhellenes in the Austin area and beyond. Tune in to Austin Hellenic Radio every Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. here on KVRX Austin 91.7 FM and online at kvrx.org. Kalia Kroasi.
All right, we are back with Dr. Joel Green, Astronomy Research Associate here at UT Austin. We've got, this is They Blind Me with Science, we've got about 10 minutes left. So, do you want to give us, maybe on a little lighter note, to talk about how you entered the field of astronomy, what your young inspiring moments were, what steered you towards this path?
Well, it's funny.
Did you want to be an astronaut when you were a kid?
Well, it's funny. Absolutely not. I think I'd get car sick. So I was figuring that being in a spaceship would be about the worst situation I could ever be in. You know, I liked watching science fiction, and I like how easy it was. They could travel around the universe. They could beam themselves. You know, I also read the Foundation novels quite a bit when I was a kid, and that was a that's actually an interesting thought experiment. If humans took over the entire galaxy, what would happen? And in that one, it's another one where there's, you know, 100 million planets, and you know it imagines societies that we couldn't even dream of, and so that really inspired me into the field because I wanted to know how does it actually work, you know, what is realistic, what could we actually achieve, and what, you know, we have all these limitations from physics. We have the speed of light. It's a serious problem. We can't get past this. The nearest star is 4 light years away. That means even round-trip communication, just by radio or SETI or anything else you want to do, is going to have an 8-year lag time, and that's the closest star. So we would really benefit if there were some faster way to get somewhere. That's why there was all this excitement over the faster-than-light neutrinos, actually, recently, which I'm not sure I believe, but it's there.
Is it still up in the air, really?
It is up in the air.
I know that it was kind of put out as a more, does anyone have anything to comment on this, kind of put out on archive more so than like a definite assertion which the media interpreted it as, but is it still, it's still fairly up in the air?
Well, I don't think anyone's really championing the fact that they really are faster than light. I think it would be hard to find somebody who is convinced by the evidence, but it is there. It's an experiment. It was done well, and there may be an error that's in it that nobody has found, but it's very subtle. So they were, you know, everyone was very excited to report these results. And so what we really need is just more experiments to confirm or deny this. And then if it turns out that it is true that these neutrinos seem to have a faster-than-light property, we're going to have to reconcile that with what we understand about how time works and causality and relativity, because there are no provisions in physics to deal with this. So it would be a kind of paradigm-bending thing.
So have you always been interested in astronomy? Is that pretty much what you wanted to do, like, from the time you started reading science fiction, like, early?
So actually, I minored in history in college, and I was originally headed that way, but I changed my mind. So I was actually quite late to the field of astronomy, but I've tried to make up for lost time. It's been really a great deal of fun. I did, to be fair, I did actually take a number of astronomy classes as a middle school and high school student, and that was great fun. I loved learning about the theoretical aspects of it. I can't say that I was really the best observer at the time, but you know, now I'm put in charge of much more elaborate observatory, so let's hope that works out better.
And I think we have a caller with a question, right?
Indeed we do. Hold on, let me put him on the air real quick. Caller, can you hear us? All right. You there?
Oh,
yeah, all right, I can hear you. Okay, well, looks like we are short on pairs of headphones, so I'm going to hand these over to Dr. Green so that he can actually listen to your question.
Okay, great.
Okay,
hello?
I can hear you now. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi. I can hear you now.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Mike. What? Question was, what have you found in terms of life on other planets?
So that's a really good question. Go ahead.
Any kind of probability that life could arise somewhere else other than here?
So that's a very important question. So that's sort of what people who discover planets are trying to answer. And there are a number of problems yet to overcome. So we can hopefully provide the number of planets that might be available for life to form on, but we do need the biologists to explain the origins of life. So that's up to them. But what we can say now is from the no pressure. but what we can say about the planets that we have found is that so there are various ways that we find planets, and some of them have huge biases in them. And some of them are very easy to understand. Some of them find planets without any bias. And so those studies, gravitational lensing in particular, show they're a very small number of planets, but they seem to suggest that our planetary system is fairly typical. So you find a lot of Jupiters and Saturn. You find a lot of Jupiters and Saturns initially because they're easier to see than Earths, because they're bigger and they're brighter. And you find planets that are very, very close to the Sun. So the very first planets discovered were gigantic, hot Jupiters that were as close to their star as Mercury is to its. These are not habitable places. These are not good places to be. Fortunately, they don't turn out to be typical because they just were the easiest to detect, so we found those first. So as we begin to delve deeper with telescopes like Kepler and surveys that we can do actually out in West Texas, so even ground-based stuff is very important, we're starting to see more of the smaller planets and more things that might be rocky planets. And so basically we're discovering that smaller planets are more common than larger planets, which is a good sign. That's kind of the best we could do right now in sort of answering the question, but at least it suggests places for programs like SETI to point or, you know, for people to look further to study with bigger telescopes that we might have in the future. So,
terrific.
Does that answer your question?
Thank you so much.
All right, and I guess just kind of for a tiny bit of background, we talked kind of which ones might have life, but how are people actually determining that these are planets out there? How do you tell if it's a planet?
Well, so I hinted that there's a few different ways to find planets. So the most obvious one is if you looked at a star and you wanted to see if it had a planet, you would just look for it. But the thing is, imagine trying to find something that is very dark next to something that's extremely bright. So imagine trying to read a piece of paper in the dark while someone's shining a flashlight in your eye and not at the paper. It's very tricky. You have contrast ratios of a million or a billion or a trillion to one. So that's hard. So there are not very many planets that have been directly imaged, but there are ways you can do that. You can find them by the effect of the gravity of the planet on the star. That's called a wobble, a gravitational wobble. And that's actually the kind of thing you can do out in West Texas. And so we have a lot of people at the university that are working on that very topic right now. Another way is this gravitational microlensing, which I probably shouldn't explain because it's a little bit bizarre, but it involves light bending around around foreground stars and sort of revealing transits of small planets. But the other way you can do it is transits, and that is sort of like an eclipse. It's when a planet, if you happen to get lucky and you look at a star, and a planet passes in front of that star, even if you can't see the planet in the star, you'll notice that the star dims by a small percentage as the planet's passing in front and then gets brighter as the planet goes behind the star again. So that is a great way to determine not only how whether there's a planet there, but how big that planet is by how long the transit takes, essentially. So that we have a telescope called Kepler that has extremely high contrast abilities, and so it's staring at a large field of the sky and finding thousands of planetary candidates right now. And this is the one that's been announcing some of these Earth-sized ones.
So, Joel, do you have any future projects in mind that you're planning on focusing on?
Well, I'm going to spend a lot of time studying these stars that have just devoured their planetary system. So that's actually my favorite topic right now. So I have a lot of programs on the Herschel Space Observatory, which is a European mission.
Man, and do we still have our caller?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe hold on. We'll keep going. I'll be back in just a second.
So the Herschel Space Observatory is a European mission, and it's actually running out now, but it's producing great science in the submillimeter microwave regime. So there we're studying the gas around these kinds of stars, and I want to see whether a dramatic flare like this has any effect on a star, and then comparing that to stars that haven't done this and seeing what the differences are. So that's sort of what my project is right now.
Oh, there we go.
And I guess I just have kind of a curiosity question. These stars that are devouring their planets, are they more common than we would think, or are they pretty rare events?
Actually, this is a good point. These stars are quite common, but the flares don't last very long. So even though I said they happen once every 10 years, that's because the flare only lasts maybe 100 years.
Oh, yes, and we have another question from a listener.
All right, Carla, can you hear us?
Oh. Mr. Green?
Yeah, okay, hold on just a second. All right, you are on the air.
Hi, I had a question for Dr. Green.
Go for it.
I've often heard said that the light that we are seeing from stars is actually light that could have already ceased to exist, and this is due to the fact light is traveling through the sky, and it's taking a long time to reach us because the stars are far away. And this always kind of confused me conceptually, how light could be traveling in this way. What does it mean for someone to say that light is taking a long time to reach us? Could you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So light has a speed, which you wouldn't initially realize. So there's a delay with light. In the same way that there's a delay with sound, when you hear echoes and things like that, light does that too. It's just much, much faster. So in normal life, in your normal life, you don't see this effect.
When you hear echoes and things like that,
Stars are actually quite far away, and they're so far away that, in fact, we measure their distance in light years. That's actually the amount of time it would take light to travel from that star to you. So the stars that I'm talking about are relatively nearby in the galaxy. So they are maybe distances of a few tens to a few hundreds or a few thousands of light years. So that means the light is delayed by 10 to a few hundred to a few thousand years. So this is light that was emitted while humans were alive, but not during, let's say, the space program. So this delay is happening from every single thing in the universe, though. And so the farther you look in distance, the farther back in time you're looking. And that's what they mean by saying that a star could be dead before the light reaches you, although you wouldn't know it, because you're seeing the movie of its life that number of years back in time. But you couldn't influence it because this is the problem with the neutrinos, the fastest way to communicate is that same light speed. So by the time you saw it and were able to get back to it, it would be gone. So there's no contradictions there. But this is the issue, is that everything across the sky is at a different distance. So you see things that are at different stages of their development by looking in different regions of the sky.
So what is light that it can travel in this way? When I see a light I see light from a light bulb, it doesn't appear that there's any sort of matter involved in it. So how is it that light is traveling? What is light, I guess, is the question.
Oh, so if we could answer this question just really quickly, we're about out of time. But thank you very much for your interest. Right.
No, thank you very much. Bye.
No, the quick answer is E=mc², right? Light is matter. Energy is matter. So light doesn't have a weight, but it has an associated energy with it. And that determines not how fast it travels, because all light travels at the same speed, but how energetic it is. And that tells you what frequencies we can see it at, and it provides you with sort of a test of that light. So maybe I'll leave it there.
All right. Well, had a lot of interest, and I'm very sorry that we have to go at the moment, but we are over time. So you've been listening to They Blind Me with Science on KBRX. We'd like to extend a very warm thank you to Dr. Joel Green and his great ability to answer all of our listeners' questions. We'll be back next week. You're listening to KBRX Austin.